Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, just try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Almost as soon as singer Amy Winehouse died in 2011 at the age of 27, people began looking back at her life and career, trying to make sense of a singular talent and a young woman for whom that singular talent wasn't enough. But somehow, Amy Winehouse's story remained a tabloid tale of alcohol abuse and addiction, and we never really got to know the person behind the hits. Until now. The new documentary called simply Amy is a powerful portrait of an artist, an addict, a daughter, and a friend. The director is Asif Kapadia. He joins us on Soundcheck to tell us more. Asif, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So how did this start? I mean, did someone approach you, or did you sort of zero in on Amy as...
I made a previous film called Senna about a Brazilian racing driver, which was made entirely out of archive.
And there That's was Ayrton Senna.
Ayrton Senna, yeah. The great Ayrton Senna, yeah.
Formula One racer.
Indeed. And that film became quite a success, actually, around the world. And somebody at Universal Music had seen that film, had liked it, and contacted my producer, James Garis, and said, look, I really love this film. What do you think? Would you be interested in making a film about Amy Winehouse? Maybe in that sort of way. And James was intrigued. He called me up. I, after Senna, had lots of offers to make sports films. And I love sport, but I didn't want to repeat myself by doing another sport film. And it was just something about that initial feeling about getting a call about Amy. I knew her music. I had her CDs. I would never have called myself a huge fan. I never saw her live, never met her. But there was something about the fact she was a local girl. And you're kind of proud when someone local does really well. And I guess there were a lot of questions which just came about with how her life panned out. It wasn't really a shock to me when I heard that she had died. I remember thinking, oh, that's a shame. But also part of me going, maybe she's in a better place because her life didn't seem to be a very enjoyable, happy one.
Right.
And I suppose all of these questions about why, but why is she on stage? Why is she doing those performances? I don't get it. I don't understand the music business. That type of thing was in my head. So I suppose when I got a call, I was intrigued to kind of get into the story, to try and see if we could try to unravel what happened.
Well, and here's someone whose life had been documented, you know, by the paparazzi, but also by all the major networks, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic. But what makes your film, what makes Amy,
I think it's very one-dimensional, the way she was documented.
Exactly,
that's the thing.
Exactly.
You didn't really know who she was. You just saw, you know, in America, they summed her up as a train wreck. There was one word. Oh, yeah. Amy, train wreck. You know, and it's like, well, I'm sure there's more to her than that.
So for you, what was the turning point?
Well, when I contacted people about Amy, nobody wanted to talk. It was still very raw. It had only been a year and a year and a half since she had died, so nobody had really dealt with her death. And I found very quickly that lots of people were in disagreement with one another. Still, you know, there was nothing had been resolved, nothing had been dealt with. She died, life went on, and people were privately grieving and angry and accusing one another and guilty. And so I started talking to people. In the end, a bit like what we're doing now. Once I kind of earned their trust, I would do audio interviews. Mm-hmm. No cameras, just sit in a sound booth, just the two of us talking, or whatever they were comfortable to speak about. And the first person I spoke to that really felt like a breakthrough, or kind of I understood a little bit of what's going on, was her first manager and friend, Nick Szymanski. He'd liked Senna as well, and we met, and we just got along. And we started to talk, and, you know, it was meant to be like for an hour or 2 hours. And before we'd know it, we'd look at a watch, and it'd be 6 hours we'd been speaking, and we'd hardly got anywhere, you know, and we'd do it again and again and again. That's really, that's how the process suddenly start to open up.
So Asif Kapadia is the director of the film Amy, and Nick Szymanski is actually here with us on Soundcheck as well. Nick, when did you first meet Amy Winehouse?
I met her when she was 16 years old, and I was 19 years old. And I'd heard about her through an artist I was managing called Tyler James. So he told me about her, and I chased her, and eventually got her on the phone, which led, after quite a few conversations, to her posting me a demo tape.
And were you with... There's a great early scene in the film of Amy in the offices of... Island Records.
That's right.
She's 18 years old.
Yeah.
It's just her and a guitar. So did you help set that up?
Yeah, that was... we just did the deal. And it was suggested by Nick Gatfield, who was the president of Island Records at the time, that to get the company motivated, you know, he was really excited about the deal, that we should come in and do an acoustic performance. And it was amazing because Amy was on such good form that day, and it really put her in good stead with the label, because everyone from the interns to the president of the label was just blown away. It was incredible.
So it doesn't look professional, it doesn't sound professional, and yet, you know,
A little kind of mini DV camera.
Yeah.
It's real, it's raw. It's like somehow, that a lot of the opening in the film is just these amazing, intimate, captured moments that somebody happened to have a camera there.
Like her friend Lauren's 14th birthday party, where Amy Winehouse takes over the singing of Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Laura. Happy birthday to you.
You know, people weren't filming it with the intention that a few years later someone would make a movie. It's just like the person turned up with a camera, filmed it. Nick did a lot of that kind of material, shot that kind of material. And it just blows you away because... yeah, there's no professional sound recordist in the room, mixing it all. It's and you just hear the power of her voice. And if it sounds good on a really bad bit of cassette tape, just imagine what it would have sounded like if you were in the room.
So she's asked about fame, and she says, well, I wouldn't know how to handle it.
How big do you think you're going to be?
I don't. At all. Because, you know, my music is not on that scale. The music is not on that scale. Sometimes I wish it was, but I don't think I'm going to be at all famous. I don't think I could handle it. I'd probably go mad, you know what I mean? I would go mad.
And she's singing a style of music where, at that point, you would think, well, you know, not likely to be a huge, big star.
She was a jazz singer. That's what she called herself. That's really her first album was kind of quite jazz-influenced.
Yeah.
She was happy. It was free. It was kind of able to go where she wanted to go. She was experimenting, I guess, working with great musicians. And it's a really good album. And the album didn't really come out here. So people in the U.S. don't
exactly.
know the first album.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Back to Black. But, this, you know, people should check out her earlier album. There's some amazing music on there.
What is it about me? My destructive side. Covering my fears, our behavioral patterns to stick over the years. Cause it's bricked up in my head, it's shoved under my bed.
Nick, was she ambitious? I mean,
she was
despite having said I couldn't handle fame, did she shoot for it?
Well, yeah, I mean, she was ambitious to make great music and to be around musicians and to play shows. That's ambition. She wasn't ambitious to make lots of money or to be famous. Like, that was never her drive. In fact, maybe, you know, in hindsight, it's more obvious now that was the case. But at the time, there was never questions about how do I get famous, how do I make money. She wasn't about that at all.
So one of the great things, Asif, about the film is you have Nick here. You have her friends, Lauren and Juliet. And the three of them have given you such a treasure trove of audio, of video. And instead of going for talking heads, you know, on camera, alternating with shots that are kind of, you know, stock or whatever, we're getting grainy, you know, home footage. It may not look great, but we're getting such an incredible portrait.
But you're in there. You're hanging
Absolutely.
Out with Amy. It's intimate. You're in the cab with her. You're in the restroom when she's doing her makeup before a gig. You know, it's funny. It's lively. They're young kids kind of just having fun, kind of as her career starting up. It's really exciting. You get that feeling. And you can see they're just being themselves. There's a real natural kind of closeness between these people. I come from a drama background, and my previous fiction films are very visual, and I'm not I don't come from a background of shooting interviews first. Mm-hmm. I come from a kind of more visual art school background. And so for me, I did that on my previous film, Senna, that was entirely made out of archive. This film, not knowing it, kind of has become a bit of a continuation. In this case, it's built around her songs. It's built around live performances. It's Amy just standing up on stage with a guitar in front of 50 people and blowing you away. You know, right at the beginning, just at a point where she's beginning to get well-known and famous in the UK. And I suppose the word that comes up a lot is raw. There's just a rawness to it, which makes it feel that much more special.
The film is called Amy. Asif Kapadia is the director, and Nick Szymanski, who was Amy's friend and first manager, also here with us on Soundcheck. And Asif, when Mitch Winehouse leaves the family, you know, there's a moment in the film where he says, you know, I was a coward, it took me a really long time, but, you know, then Amy was okay and stuff. There's an interesting kind of clash of points of view at that moment in the film. And I guess that's, for you as a filmmaker, there's a couple of instances of that, right? Where people see the same thing from different angles.
I mean, yeah, what we were trying to do was just to show how complex Amy's situation was. She's a young girl. She's caught up in the middle of things. She's very intelligent. She's very complicated herself. And her circumstances just got more and more complicated. And she was, I guess, in certain times being pulled in different directions by different people, all of whom I'm sure loved her and cared about her. But it just felt like one decision after another was being made, which in the long term probably wasn't the best for her. Mm. And I think the film's aim is just to show everything that went on, all of the people around her. It's a really, sometimes it's, you know, it's a very delicate issue. You're dealing with someone who's died, and you're dealing with family, you're dealing with friends, you're dealing with husband, boyfriends, all of this sort of stuff. The aim of the film really was to focus on Amy so that people would get more of an understanding of her. Because at the ending, the image of Amy was always like, she's just a train wreck. She's a mess. It's all her fault. What we tried to do is backtrack and show you, actually, she was great. But she had a few issues. She had problems of her own. She made decisions of her own. But other people also made decisions.
Well, and, you know, in the ending of this scene, she talks about depression and about... Well, let's hear. This is an excerpt from the film Amy.
I don't think I knew what depression was. I knew I felt funny sometimes and I was different. I think it's a musician thing. That's why I write music. Yeah, I'm not like some messed up person, you know. There's a lot of people that suffer with depression that don't have an outlet, do you know what I mean? Can't pick up a guitar for an hour and feel better.
So Asif, you know, depression as something that drives the songwriting, anybody listening to the lyrics would probably have cottoned on to that at some point, right?
I don't think so. I don't remember anyone talking about this at the time. I think actually people would just dance along to the songs. I think hardly people talked about her voice. I don't remember people really talking about her songwriting.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you had actually like looked at the lyrics in front of you, for example, the lyrics of Back to Black.
Me and my head high and my tears dry. Get on without my guy.
So we see this wonderful footage of Amy Winehouse in the recording studio. She's laying down the vocal track by herself in the booth for the song Back to Black. And then we switch over to the finished version with the band supporting her. But then at the end, we switch back to just the vocal track, and there's Amy in the studio singing this.
Oh, it's a bit upsetting at the end, isn't it?
Those are pretty dark lyrics.
I mean, that's really what comes out of the film, I suppose, is once you understand her life and her story and what's actually gone on, you realise every song is based on a real person, a real incident. It's her documenting her life in a very, very raw, personal way. every now and again there's a twist of kind of a line, there's a bit of humour in there, there are cultural references in there, but it's all based on truth, and that's why it's so heavy, and that's why it was so heavy for Amy to sing these songs later on. You know, she couldn't just bang them out. It wasn't something that 50 people in the back room had written. It was all her writing. It was a diary. Really, these albums are her diary. The film's trying to visualise her diary and understand what's going on deep inside her.
So for that reason, the movie is kind of full of premonitions of things that will come. Nick, there's a moment where she calls you on the phone to say, I haven't heard from you in a while. I love you, and I'll love you until the day my heart bursts and I fall down dead.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, had you been not taking her calls at that point?
Yeah, I mean, when you watch the film, you see that, you know, myself, Juliet and Lauren, we did everything we could to try and get her to focus on rehab and to try and get better. And then it got to a point where I had to take a position and just say to her, I'm here if you need me, I'm here if you want to get better, but I'm not going to be around, I'm not going to book the shows, I'm not going to show up and hang out while you're in this state, I can't watch it happen. And so so with that, I went quiet. I decided to kind of, you know, take a stance. And then she left me that message, which was, you know, Amy could be very charming, you know, and she knew that I wasn't in a good place with the whole thing. She probably knew I was right. She knew that I was doing it for the right reasons. And so she left me that really beautiful message.
And you kept it.
I kept it. You know, I actually think answer phone messages are some of the kind of nicest mementos to have, because we all, you know, I don't know about you, but with me, there's a lot of playful answer phone messages. You say things. Sometimes when you know someone's not there, you can be a bit more free.
Yeah. It's just that here we seem to change our phones every year or two, and, you know, then
they're still quite easy to record. You just hold them on GarageBand and on your laptop, or, you know, tape machine, whatever, and then you've got the memento. But, you know, some people find that a bit strange, but to me, it's, you know, I've always kept lots of photography. I've always filmed stuff. I've always recorded stuff.
Well, it's a really wonderful moment in the film. Again, the movie is Amy, which is out now, directed by Asif Kapadia and Nick Szymanski, Amy's friend and first manager, an important part of it. Asif, how well-known was Amy's bulimia during her lifetime?
Again, I mean, it seems so obvious now when you look at her and you see how her body changes, but I don't think it was well-known. It wasn't particularly documented. I think quite kind of towards the ending, I remember reading an article from someone in her family, I think it was her brother, gave an interview where he mentioned it, but nobody else really talked about it. And what came out of talking to people in the interviews is that lots of people had witnessed it separately. And just somehow, something about Amy's life is that most people weren't talking to another. They were not connecting up, so they weren't realizing there's a pattern. You know, so different people at different moments of stress witnessed her doing things that were harming her, I guess. But people were all in separate little compartments. I think in the end, what her doctor did say to me was that, you know, it's the bulimia, long-term bulimia and alcohol that made her heart stop, and that's why she died. You know, she did have a huge problem with drugs during her life, and that evidently wasn't good for her, but it's actually alcohol and bulimia that killed her.
Well, now, she goes to, St. Lucia? St. Lucia in the Caribbean to get away from the drugs. Also, Blake Fielder, her husband, you have him, maybe not on screen, but we hear him, he sounds like a beaten old man, where he's talking about, you know, getting into drugs with Amy. And
I think all of these guys are much older than the actual years because of what they put their bodies through. You know, you hear someone who's probably done quite a lot of damage to his voice because of drugs and various things, but also I think there's a lot of guilt, there's a lot of, you know, pain in the voice as well. You know, he's you know, he's not the same person now that he was then. You know, that's the thing you have to realize. People have grown up. Everyone has grown up. Everyone, they were kids. Right. They were kids. They all thought that, you know, the world revolved around them. They thought they knew it all, but they were 22, 23 years old. And you're an idiot. When you're a kid, you make mistakes when you're in that age. Now you're a bit older and you suddenly realize, oh my God, what was I? But everyone else has somehow got through it. The person who's not around is Amy.
Right. And he sounds racked with regret in the film.
The guy that I met and I spoke to a couple of times fully admits what he did. You know, he's I don't know if he's clean. I don't know, you know, where he is, but he's trying to move on. He doesn't live in London. He's away. He has family. He's trying to kind of get by.
Yeah.
It's, I can see when you look at him, you know, it's a struggle. You can literally see on him all of the wounds of the kind of life that he's led. It's tricky, you know. You meet people and suddenly you understand them a bit more. You hear that he had lots of issues when he was growing up. She had issues when she was growing up. They meet, they can see they've got a hell of a lot in common, you know, and that's what makes them connect. It's all so much more complicated than the kind of paparazzi version, which is essentially what everyone got in this country.
Right. Now, so she's in the Caribbean and her dad shows up with a camera crew and gives you access to that footage. Is that just a lack of self-awareness? Did he not realize how he was going to come off looking when she's trying to get away and here's dad and he's got a film crew with him?
I don't know. I'm sure at the time he had his own reasons for it and he thought he was doing it for the right reason. I mean, that footage is kind of out there because it was a TV show that went on network TV in England. And so the way these films work is that, you know, that material is available from whoever made the TV show.
Yeah.
You know, I it's just another part of people making decisions, which when you look at it, they all add up to saying, well, this probably wasn't the best for her at that moment in time when she was trying to get away. But, you know, even in St. Lucia, you know, it's the place where people said she kind of was able to get off the drugs like heroin and crack and all these, you know, other narcotics that she was on. But actually, she just switched from one to another because that's where she was staying in a place where there was alcohol, which was on tap.
Yeah.
And so she didn't get rid of the drugs. She just switched from one drug to another drug.
Yeah. So, you know, later in her career, she's followed by the paparazzi, and there is a kind of, Asif, there's a kind of nightmarish quality to those scenes where she's walking in or out of her house. Everyone knows where she lives. And you know, the flashing and the strobing effect is really, it's upsetting to watch.
It's supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's not nice being caught up in that, particularly if you're not well, which she wasn't. You know, a young petite girl walking down the street being surrounded by 50, 60 men chasing after her with these cameras and flashing. They do blind you. If you've ever been in that situation, you don't know where you are. You do get disorientated. And I wanted the audience to feel that. I wanted it to feel quite visceral. It wasn't just a matter of people going, oh, and then she became famous. When you're in the middle of it, it's hell, actually. And her life, and, you know, that went on for years.
Yeah.
That's the bit you cannot comprehend. That became normal for about 5 years of her life or 4 years of her life, something like that. Everywhere she went, she was being followed by people because it's just her bad luck. She was a girl that was famous. She was a girl with the song Rehab. They're trying to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, you'll go no. She's the one walking down the street in Camden, which at that point was like the centre of the universe artistically, or in London particularly, it was where everything was going on. And it's when the media went digital. Suddenly they need more, more, more. We need websites to update. We need newspapers mm-hmm. that are going out daily. You know, and there's a media war going on. There's phone hacking going on. Everything happened to go on. Suddenly YouTube, Facebook, you know, all of these websites pop up, which they want media. They want people to click, and Amy was a person people kept clicking on.
Yeah.
They wanted to see more terrible shots of her. They wanted to see more terrible performances of her.
So the upshot of all this is there is a certain inevitability to the story. I mean, we come into the film knowing how it's going to end, but between the things that she says, you know, early on in the career, fame, I wouldn't be able to handle it, to the call to Nick, to, you know, the lyrics that we hear from Back to Black, all of that. You just kind of get this feeling of an inexorable kind of momentum towards the end. As a filmmaker dealing with this, did you feel that as well?
I think what we felt that is actually there seemed to be lots of opportunities when things could have been stopped and it could have gone a different way. I don't know if it's kind of like a given that she has to be performing at certain points when she was in that way. You know, I think for me, I don't know anything. I don't know how the music business works. I didn't know anyone in the film before I started making it. But if you win that many Grammys, for me, you then deserve a holiday.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't take a break after you've just won 5 Grammys and, you know, you're top of the world, when do you deserve a break? But I don't know. That's what kind of what happened. Like I said, I'm an outsider to that world. And it seemed like I don't know who the person is within the industry and the entertainment business and the music business who's sitting there going, do you know what? This probably isn't the best thing for the artist.
Well,
I'm not a believer in all publicity is good publicity.
Yeah. The great thing about this film is, as I say, you know how it's going to end. You cannot help rooting for this girl, this young woman.
Once you see her in the beginning, once you realise what a wonderful human being she was, how funny she was, how intelligent she was, how brilliant she was, and you fall for her, then it's really difficult to watch what happens to her later. If you don't know who she was, if she's not a human being to us, it's really easy to enjoy someone's downfall. And that's sadly what happened, particularly in this country. Yeah. Particularly in this country, because nobody knew who she was before. We had a sense of her because that first album came out. Londoners were aware of her. We knew she didn't always look like that. But I think it's been really interesting showing a film here in the US. There's a much bigger journey that the audience goes on here. People in the industry, journalists who interviewed her. I would talk to the journalists and they would really talk about her in a very kind of, they had a very low opinion of her. And I was like, I was saying, you didn't meet her. And they're like, I met her. I spent half an hour with her. She didn't say a word. And I thought, that's not Amy. You know, yeah. You met someone else there.
So the title, which seems on the surface to be as simple a title as possible, actually must have been pretty considered on your part.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea was to take her off the pedestal, take her away from being this pop star and this icon, take away the beehive, take away the makeup, all of that stuff, and actually just show the raw human being underneath it, who actually was in a lot of pain and was suffering and happened to be in a limelight and maybe didn't even want to be in that limelight. She just wanted to be an artist, wanted to create.
And Nick Szymanski, after it's been 4 years, what is it like to see that person again, to hear that person again on the screen?
Nowhere near as good as being with the real person at the time, but that can't happen. So at least the beginning of the film, we're showing that beautiful, talented, brilliant side of her. The whole thing's surreal, but I think this film needed to be made. It's been made the right way. We weren't sure for a long time if it would come out being such a strong film, but I think Asif and his team have done a great job. And you know, I think it's more than just Amy's story. It's a social commentary. There's big questions raised, and I think for that alone, you know, hopefully if a small percentage of people watch the film and come away with a bit more thought about everything, then great, amazing.
Yeah, it is a powerful film, a poignant film. Thank you so much, Asif and Nick, for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Get instant updates from Soundcheck anytime by following us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll tell you when you can listen to live performances happening in our studio, when we've got new interviews up for you to hear, and when we post new videos online. We're on Twitter at Soundcheck. And on Facebook at facebook.com/WNYC Soundcheck.